This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And our topic this week is...
photo editing and management updates.
I think when you told me that it's been something like 20 episodes since the last episode, I couldn't even believe it.
I did say last time we talked about photo editing and photo management. We did talk about photo stuff more recently, still been a couple of months since that.
Yeah, it's just time flies these days. We have some follow-up. And first is an administrative note, which is that our summer hiatus that we do every year is on the way. So the last episode before the summer hiatus will be released on July 30th. That's episode 211. And our first episode returning from the hiatus will be released on September 10th, which is episode 212. So... we just wanted to pre-announce that because there are only a few episodes left before we go on hiatus. So prepare yourself mentally for missing out on the podcast for a couple of weeks.
And I would like to congratulate you. You didn't fuck up the numbers.
It's true. I tried really hard this time. next item of follow-up is something I have talked about on and off on the podcast over the last 3 years, and that is that I finally completed my Gran Turismo 4 B-Spec run. Almost exactly 3 years ago, I started my run on June 8th, 2020, and I finished it on May 25th of 2023.
3 years, wow.
Yeah, so what I did was an any percent run, which is to say the only goal was to beat the GT World Championship and all events before that without playing any A-spec on that save. And I have a photo of my status screen that shows that I have zero A-spec points and, like, I don't know how many hundreds of, or maybe thousands of B-spec driver experience points up. I beat the GT World Championship on my second attempt. It was incredibly stressful because each attempt takes about, like, 2 hours of playback, even with like a 3x fast forwarding in B-spec. So it is incredibly time consuming, and it came down to the very last few seconds of my last race. Wow. Which was incredibly stressful. That was a lot of fun to do. I gotta say, the Gran Turismo 4 I think is much more clearly balanced around A-spec mode, or at least a mix of A-spec and B-spec mode. If you try playing it in B-spec mode, the pacing gets absolutely brutal after a while, because if you've played Gran Turismo 4 before, you know that there's the special condition races, which is where you can go and get the Toyota RSC, which you can sell for a lot of money, and it's a very easy race. So it's like one of the easiest grinding paths in the entire game, except the problem is special condition races are A-spec only, so you can't use that grinding spot in that game. So instead, I had to use some more creative methods. I believe there was a Stars and Stripes race in the American Races Pavilion that gave you some Camaro concept car, but like not a concept that you can't sell. It was like a concept you could sell for like 240,000 credits or something like that. So that was a good grinding spot. And there was another one in the European events for like the Italian Cup, which gave you some car that was worth like 280,000 credits or something like that. So those were some good grinding spots. And I managed to save up my money to buy up a Mazda 3... Mazda 787B, I think is called. The green and orange Renown branded Mazda race car that is very popular in that game because... let's be honest, it's the only car you can buy that you can beat the GT World Championship with without completing 25% of the game to unlock endurance races. I found this out the hard way when I got to the end of the game and I was like, fuck, how do I get a car that can actually beat the GT World Championship? And that was my only option, or I had to grind it out until 25% and then go get actual race cars in the endurance races. I think I finished the game at around 20%, so like I would have had to do quite a few races and buy quite a few cars to actually be able to get to 25% just to be able to grind to get another race car. So I thought, well, instead of doing that, I'm just going to grind to get the 787B, which is not ideal, I must admit. That's kind of why the pacing got brutal, because I had to grind for a really, really long time to get I think it was 3.5 million credits to buy that car.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't recommend it unless you are a specific flavor of masochist or just a big Gran Turismo 4 fan.
Or just call you Nick Mania.
Yeah, it's true. But yeah, I finally completed it and it was really exciting. So now that I've actually have like all of the proof that I've actually done that run, I can actually use that save as a base for a 100% run with A-Spec races, which is interesting. So I might do that over the next few years. I don't know. I have a lot of other long-term grinding games I want to get through. So it'll probably follow me for the rest of my life, let's be honest. But
okay, yeah. That's what you mean is slowly but surely beat the game at 100%.
Yeah, because like this is the first time I've ever beat Gran Turismo 4 and seen the credits. I had never done it in A-Spec before. So it's an interesting way to do it. And the rationale behind it was I had done the early game of Gran Turismo so many times that I kind of didn't want to do it again in A-Spec. I just wanted to try it in a different way. And I ended up doing the whole game in B-Spec, which is certainly an adventure. And the early game is much rougher on B-Spec because your driver doesn't have enough experience. So he sucks and he just completely goes off course in ways that even I don't in A-Spec. There was a long period of time. I'm trying to remember the name of the track. I think it's Infineon Raceway. Like, I don't know why, but my driver absolutely hates that track. Every single time he would just like, there's a slalom part with a bunch of S curves and he would just go straight through it. Like, I don't give a fuck, but like he would go straight through it and like crash and lose the race every single time.
Oh my.
So I had to make him run races on Infineon Raceway like 30 in a row for him to stop doing that. So I just
really 30? Oh my goodness.
I lost count, but it was like, I just left it on while I was working. I was just like, drive at the slowest speed, just try to finish the race without crashing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So not the greatest of experiences, but it's certainly a fun adventure. So I'm glad that that's over. Now I get to actually enjoy the other races of the game that I've never actually had the chance to play because I never beat the game before. So exciting times ahead for Gran Turismo 4. Anyway, I think we have some follow-up about Final Cut.
Yes, we do. So since our last episode, the Final Cut Pro and Logic Pro apps for iPad are out. So are the reviews. So you will be able to find in the show notes for this episode three links to YouTube videos. The first one from Petapixel, the second one from The Verge, and the third one from Mary Spender. And there are three interesting reviews of said products that I've seen in the past 2 weeks. That I strongly suggest you go watch. I would even put an asterisk to the last one saying the Mary Spender video is quite interesting. My understanding, first time I hear of her, but my understanding, the journey she explains in the video part of it also being a review is as a music producer, or more or less as an artist, and also being a YouTuber. Those two apps on the iPad are pretty interesting for her. I don't want to spoil too much, but that was an interesting take and quite different from a lot of the takes I've heard in a lot of the reviews. The Petapixel / the Verge one are pretty typical, meaning that they are from video editors reviewing Final Cut Pro. And I didn't include too much of the Logic Pro reviews that I've seen with the main caveat because is that those reviews are a lot from people in the Apple sphere and a lot of them are podcaster. So they kind of use Logic Pro on the Mac to do that. And one of the limitation that was discovered since the last recording of this podcast is that while the data format might be a bit more compatible between Logic Pro on the Mac and on the iPad, one big feature that a lot of people that uses Logic Pro to edit podcasts is not present, and it is the time-based timelines. So more or less not using tones and music notes. So Logic Pro for iPad is mainly compatible with making music, which I know a lot of people have been editing podcasts with Logic Pro on the Mac, but it's been years since everybody knows that. It's not really well made for this. It's mainly a music tool creation, a bit like GarageBand. GarageBand used to have features. They completely removed them. I think you can still bring back this timeline, this time-based timeline, and not just base it on music notes. But still, even to this day, using GarageBand to do podcasts is not what it is intended for. So a lot of those reviews where they say, hey, it's not really well made for iPad, but I still use it for that, was kind of, I don't know, they kind of left a bit of a sour taste in my mouth. Compared to video editors saying, you know what, I use a lot of the functionality on Final Cut Pro 10 on the Mac, and here's what's missing, or here's what I don't like because it is different, seems more fair, I think, for the product compared to people that are not musicians trying to make not music on it for that. And I think that's why I'm including Mary Spender's video, because she's a musician and she's making music with it and she has different opinions. And I think they are worth well watching it. I know, Yannick, you also watch a lot of videos and you came out of watching those videos with hot takes.
You're right. So I think there's kind of an issue in the Apple sphere with with iPad Pro apps, which is a lot of people want Pro apps on the iPad, but they don't use the ones that exist. So then when Final Cut comes out, they have no frame of reference for what exactly exists already on the iPad, and they just act like the shit is new and innovative when it's not. And that's kind of the viewpoint I had for all of this Final Cut stuff, is that when I look at people reviewing Final Cut, they're like, oh, this is such a brand new take on how to do Pro apps on the iPad. And I'm like, not only is this not a new approach to making Pro apps on the iPad, it is actually worse than what I am currently using in LumaFusion in a lot of ways. And I just have a problem where, like, I know that it is the first big Apple Pro app pair released on the iPad, and like that's worthy of being a big deal, but you can't just pretend like the other apps don't exist. Otherwise, you're kind of doing a poor job of reviewing the product and comparing it to what exists on the market. And I think I watched very many reviews and I did not see one mention of LumaFusion at all. I have used a bunch of other editors over the years and none of those have been mentioned either. You barely saw people mention iMovie for iOS, which is, I mean, it's not the greatest, but it didn't exist. I've used like Pinnacle. I've used, there was another thing between Pinnacle and LumaFusion that I used.
Did you watch the Tyler Solomon review?
I think so.
Okay, because if I have a recollection that he does mention a lot of other editors, because if it's not LumaFusion, isn't it one
it's
called
DaVinci Resolve, right?
I think he mentioned Resolve.
Right, but I think it was being compared to the desktop version of Resolve, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but I have a vague memory that you mentioned comparing it with other iOS editor. But again,
I'll have to rewatch it. But like, even just not comparing it to DaVinci Resolve, which is another professional-grade application that exists on the iPad, which is honestly probably the biggest competitor to Final Cut Pro. If you're talking about really like professional workflows, like DaVinci Resolve is used by a lot of professionals in professional workflows, and you can use it on the iPad for that.
Right.
The fact that I only heard it maybe mentioned once is alarming to me, because it means you're not really giving a real review of Final Cut as it compares to other video editors on the platform. And it's also worrisome, because like, I didn't want to call you out on it too much on the desktop class iPad apps thing. Like, LumaFusion is already doing a lot of stuff a lot better than Final Cut is. And I don't think Final Cut is necessarily making the right UI choices for what makes sense on the iPad. And there have been years of usage of those apps that you can look at for evidence of why those patterns are good or bad for different use cases. And Final Cut doesn't look like it learned from any of that. It's exactly the same thing that I was worried about with the pencil editing in Ferrite. Like, that is a game changer that makes you incredibly productive while editing. And we're going to put aside the whole thing where Logic isn't interested in doing podcasts, therefore a lot of this usefulness is lost. But there's still lessons that could have been learned from Ferrite, even though it's not directly applicable in all cases to the music making sphere. And I feel like we're just getting the iPad Pro apps that we should have gotten 10 years ago instead of the evolved versions that we would have had today if Apple had released it 10 years ago.
I think you're making a good point, and we had this discussion also off the record, or I guess offline, I should say, and you got me quite curious to see LumaFusion until I realized it was like, I think, $40 Canadian, and I have literally zero video editing needs, so I'm like, yeah, next time we see each other, I gotta play with your iPad and possibly some of your footage just to experience the UI. And it is true that a lot of the reviews are from Mac video editor trying to see if the iPad would fit on their workflow versus people that are already using the iPad. And I wouldn't be surprised that slowly but surely those reviews will come out where the people that do video editing on the iPad or music creation on the iPad will come out and say, hey, no, you know what? Like, people might have real problems because they come from the Mac and then kind of trying to downside, quote unquote, to the iPad version. But if you're already used to X application, let's take LumaFusion, you might like this or you might dislike that. And I'm eager for those reviews to come out. And that's, again, that's the take I felt throughout the review from Mary Spender. So that's why I'm putting it there. It is a different vibe from the typical tech review. And on top of that, I think she does bring a different perspective to those two tools. I kind of agree with you, though, that they don't feel like 2023 iPad Pro applications. They kind of feel like maybe 2018 when the first iPad Pro came out and things like that. No, it was a bit before that, but I think the 2018 was the first square edges iPad, but give or take, I wouldn't say 10 years old, but still a couple of years old. I think the iPad has evolved a lot. And yeah, it seems that even Apple is not really realizing that just yet.
Yeah, I think one of the big issues is that like Final Cut seems to be like this is just a UI pattern I noticed, which really bugged me, is they're trying to cram all of the adjustments you can do in a sidebar, and you have multiple different sidebars you can bring up on screen, but they're ultimately just all sidebars. And if I wanted to edit the same thing in LumaFusion, I would double tap the clip and I would get a full screen takeover just for various kinds of adjustments. So I have much more real estate to fit adjustments on screen and a higher density of adjustments than just choosing what looks aesthetically pleasing in a slim sidebar, right? Because Apple is going to value what looks good in a screenshot over overall density. By no means am I saying that LumaFusion looks nicer than Final Cut. Like, I'm fully willing to admit that. It's uglier, okay?
But it is, like, denser of a UI, too.
Yes.
The things I recall from screenshots.
It is more usable by someone who has to do a lot of shit regularly. And it's just quicker than having to deal with the much nicer looking UI. And there are ways to make the quicker, uglier UI from LumaFusion work nicer and prettier. You just didn't put the effort in to do that. But anyway, we can talk about this later. I don't want to hijack the whole episode with this. It's just, it made me cranky. And people should be giving LumaFusion more credit than they do.
I think we should just mention one small thing, kind of it's about how the show is made, is that, was that today or yesterday? I've kind of forgotten now, but when I asked Yannick if he had any follow-up, and he just mentioned the hiatus and the
B-Spec.
Beating B-Spec. I was a bit surprised to say that you didn't want to talk about your hot take in relation to the reviews coming out. I was like, oh yeah, I wanted to mention that the reviews are coming out. I was like, okay, then I'll use that to talk about my hot takes for Final Cut Pro and the iPad. Like, okay, good. Perfect. So I guess it's time to jump to the main topic. Yannick, are you excited that we're talking about photo management and photo editing again?
Kind of, yeah.
Okay, that's not the answer I was expecting, but I am.
I'm worried about what's coming. I don't know how your workflow has evolved, but if it involves Lightroom, I'm not going to be happy.
It is a great segue because I think we should start with a small recap. If you haven't been listening to the podcast in the past few months, I've been through a photographic journey in the last, at this point, 18 months to nearly 2 years. Yeah, I think we're getting closer to 2 years.
I am pretty sure it's 2.5-ish years.
No, because the way I recall it is it started around fall 2021. So 18 months is give or take. But yes, I'm getting into this range where it's not just a few months, it's getting into the years, where I decided to have a renewed focus on photography. And I wanted to start this episode because it's been a couple of few months where we discuss. So I kind of want to have this information on top of our mind while we discuss the other topics. So last time we did an episode about photo editing and photo management was episode 189, Photo Management Therapy, which was this episode, by the way. So strongly suggest you go listen to it again because it was literally a therapy session. I don't expect this one to be one, but it is well worth your time. But the gist of this episode is I decided to move to Adobe Lightroom CC. I'll nickname it this way, even if it's just called Adobe Lightroom, but the cloud version, as my sandbox for photo management and photo editing. This means that for every photo I take with a dedicated photo equipment, that's my own way of saying, aka nothing from the iPhone, ends up in this program first. I made this quick distinction about the iPhone because even since I decided to change my workflow, I haven't really had dedicated shooting session or just shooting events where the iPhone was the main daily driver. So I didn't really explore if I end up, let's say, with 50, 100, 1,000 photos on my phone that I kind of want to have this triaging process plus editing process, what would I do? But I guess that's gonna, when that happens, that's gonna be food for another episode. So right now, when I take photos, which would be maybe once or twice during a photo event, I could end up taking a couple of photos just to text to friends and things like that. Like those, they start in the Apple Photo and they stay in Apple Photo. And usually I kind of take it as more of a baked JPEG if I would have taken it from the camera and just start using the benefits of a connected camera that is a cell phone with amazing capabilities. Also, for nearly a year at this point, and that I'm pretty sure because I remember clearly late July, early August, I started to shoot film, and I discussed this in episode 197, Procrastination is Part of the Process. Oh man, I love this title. And that was just released in January of this year, so a couple of months after I started. And it was a great comeback episode after our holiday break. Even if I shoot film, I don't have the intention to create a dark room in my apartment. So for sure, yes, I have negative strips. I haven't started any slide film yet, but that's a different topic. But in the end, the output results is scanned images, right? I have the negatives, but I really end up with scans, not having to go in the dark room and make my own 4x6, or even asking the lab to give me 4x6 or any printed format. I want them to be digital and then decide which one I want to print. So with this small recap, you're kind of more or less up to date. Again, I strongly suggest if you want to hear more details about my own journey through film photography and how I ended up deciding to use Lightroom as somebody that doesn't like Adobe products, I strongly suggest you revisit those two episodes. But we do have a foundation, a layer to build on top of that. Before we go about how did my photo management and editing has changed in the past few months, or didn't change, I do have other general photo updates. It wouldn't be a Limipo photo episode without me just generally talking about photography. But again, this should be a quick one, unlike our previous episodes.
Famous last words.
look at your watch and then we'll see. Quick note, and I guess it's, I use that as a teaser, but if you follow me on Instagram, you might have seen in early April around Easter time, I had the opportunity to develop two of my own roll of film. I bought myself the equipment to develop myself, mainly for black and white. And that's fun. I don't want to talk too much about it today because I think after I end up developing even more roles, I really want to have a dedicated film development episode. No guarantee when it will happen, but again, since Easter, that's the only two roles I have developed. So I want to have a bit more experience with this process. I want to go through a couple of more roles of black and white before making it a fully fledged episode. But the TLDR on me developing my own film is, it's pretty fun. Are you surprised that in the last episode where I was talking about the processes and the tactile, the tactileness of film photography and analog photography, that guess what? I kind of start to enjoy even more tactile processes where you play with water and chemicals and then boom, you end up with images on pieces of plastics. So that's quite the shortened summary of what is development, but it is a fun process. And again, it's kind of pushing me to want to do even more black and white during my day to day. The main downside right now is while I have the developing equipment, I don't have that much, or I still ended up with no or limited scanning equipment, and we'll see, because that I need to start considering. So right now I only have two rolls of black and white that I've shot and developed myself, and they were not for specific event, they were just like walked around, so it's okay that they end up in sleeves in my binder of negatives, so that if I end up with equipment in 3 or 4 months or more than that, like, I can scan them. So that's kind of my in between right now, where I started to develop and experience that, but I kind of feel a bit not willing to shoot too much black and white because I want to develop myself, but then I need to wait to fully see my images on screen because I have no scanning equipment. Next up is, I had a goal starting mentioned in the January episode about film photography, which was, I want this year, so from August to January 20, or early January 2022, so in 2022, in about 4 or 5 months, I shot about 15 rolls of film, and I was saying that, hey, I should start buying film and shoot it, and I had a goal of saying, hey, I want to shoot in 2023 at least 30 rolls of film, and today, on the recording, we're literally on June 1st, so literally in the middle of the year, or 5 months in, and starting the 6th, I am at 17 rolls. So I am pretty on track. And again, lots of event coming soon. Also a lot of a vacation where I plan to shoot even more films. So I'm pretty good on track on that goal of crossing this 30 plus barrier of film in 2023. Last but not least, even if I've shot a lot of film in the past few months, and I kind of, I would say I consider primarily a film shooter or film photographer, my digital bodies are not collecting dust. So both the Fuji X100S and the Nikon D5000, I've seen usage in the recent months. And again, because I ended up with, yes, digital assets and both flows, depending of what I shoot, the photo management changes a bit, and we'll see that right away. Because, and then there are a couple of differences, and a lot of them, are you really surprised, are kind of self-inflicted. I think that could be a quite good summary of this podcast in general, is a lot of what we complain about is self-inflicted.
Yes.
But I'm not too teasing too much the rest of the episode. So first, I want to talk about the digital bodies, because this is what I've seen the least changes since I talk about using Adobe Lightroom. So the reason I bring it up again is, remember the last episode, I was talking about the dread of photo management. And I think for my digital bodies, I think that is more or less resolved. And getting into a good mood about it. So as I mentioned in the recap section, I would literally pull out the SD card for my cameras, put them in the computer or the iPad, import them into an album, and go from there. I have multiple projects today that I can say that photos stayed inside Adobe Lightroom, that in my sandbox that I described, which means that those photos, for certain reasons or not, I don't ever envision and those ending up in my library. A couple of examples of why is, I remember an event from last summer that in the end, I kind of pressed the button too much, and I should have been a bit more critical of myself while I was there. And a lot, if not all, the photos kind of like in the end didn't vibe with what I wanted to do. So they said that, and you know what? I could even say that at some point they just should be deleted. Another example is during a specific photo lesson that I did in December. This was a studio event. So it was a really nice day where in the morning we would have three different studio sets, and we would have people come in. It was literally people that were part of this lesson that was there for this purpose of allowing us to learn how to do photo shoots in the studio. And in the end, I didn't want to end up with photos of strangers in my library. And like, it's different if we were talking about vacation photos where you're visiting a new city, or if I were to do street photography here in Montreal. Yes, of course, you'll end up with strangers in those photos. Here we're talking about like studio portraits, like
models, you cannot and miss stuff, it. Right? Yeah.
And not even like, I think those two were really funny, but like one was a family. It was a couple and their daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the teacher's cousin. So it's like, it's not my family. Like we practice and they're still in my Lightroom library catalog. Like, but I don't want them in my photo library. It's not my family, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But as having that as a sandbox, it was allowing me, like, I had to prepare photos to then have them in, because following that whole day, so in the morning there was the shooting, and then in the afternoon we spent time at the studio with the teacher doing post-processing of the photo, importing what are the types of edits, tweaks that the teacher does when she does studio portraits, and then give us tips and tricks. But for sure, we were not doing the 200, 300, 400 photos that we shot that morning, right? Mm-hmm. We would focus on certain techniques, and then the idea is you would bring what you've learned back home, and then 2 weeks after we would have a Zoom session where in advance we would have to submit photos to the teacher, and then as a group people would go back. And then the idea too is there was this small family, and the two other models were kid actors. So there's next to where the photo store is, they do have a kid actor agency, and the teachers have a good relationship with the manager of that agency, and they use that to bring subject for the photo classes, and also the agency uses that to have maybe not fully professional studio portraits, but at least have a different variety of shots for them. So that was kind mm-hmm. of the give and take approach there is, they were there to have their portraits taken, also for us to practice managing a model in the studio, with the benefit of having those photos submitted at the end. But again, like, I don't want to have the photos of a random like 15-year-old in my photo library. Like,
understandable.
I don't care, right? But those, I don't mind if they stuck in Lightroom, because Lightroom is Lightroom. They will never end up on my TV in my living room. Mm-hmm. They will never ever end up in my screenshot. And that was really freeing. Again, I know you mentioned that, I forgot, Gemini, you mentioned that, yeah, you should take the time every couple of days or every day before going to bed to clean up the library. I think I'm not there yet. I struggle to press delete sometime on certain of those photos. But I think I'm slowly getting there too, saying like, you know what? Yes, there's a mess of 10 years of photos, but I put them in albums like we last discussed. I started to like when I see photos going, photos that is suggested by the quote unquote algorithm, from the memories, the snap, the screenshot and things like that. Like I would tend to go back and be like, yes, I like them. So I'm slowly building back my catalog of liked photos because we lost a lot of the star ratings that was available in Aperture or iPhoto. And I'm slowly building this back. So it's kind of doing this cleanup, but it's not deleting the files, which means that with this process of putting all my files in Lightroom and once I'm done exporting JPEGs, I usually have a triage process to doing when I do the export. I don't export everything. I will triage and then slowly but surely the house is getting cleaner or it's not getting dirtier, I should say, at least. So that part is good. And I'm also really good with living with things are staying in Lightroom CC. The main problem with that approach is now I'm like thinking about, oh yeah, now I have two cloud solutions that I kind of need to manage and that I kind of need to figure out how to back up.
Yeah.
And I'm not the best at backing up my photos in Apple Photos. So please don't judge me or please don't hack my Apple ID. Yeah, so I'm kind of thinking about that. But I kind of realized, I'm also realizing that a lot of the photos I don't like, they might not be deleted, but I am okay with them at some point getting deleted. It's going to be okay that I get rid of those RAWs at some point.
Mm-hmm.
The one that are in Lightroom CC. So that's where I ended up with the digital bodies. It's super fun to put them in Lightroom. I have a good example that I'll come back because also related to how I shot film and things like that. But I attended an event at the end of the, at earlier this month or in May, I should say. And again, literally 2 days ago, I had to submit my photos for another Zoom session where we discussed. And this long period where things were in Lightroom, not polluting Apple Photo Library, was also a good step back moment. The event in the end, and I can, I'll go with a tangent. So I ended up doing an event, Bright Sunday. It was a blacksmithing contest. It was in the end super fun, but it was at the beginning of the month. Oh, first nice few days, sunny outside, blah, blah, blah. So I'm like, oh yes, it's time to use my low ISO film. It's sunny outside. Up until I arrive at the blacksmithing contest. And it's inside of a barn. And the ISO film I had with me was 200. You can imagine how it went. Not so great. At least luckily for me, I did have my Fuji X100S. But like I was prepared to use my zoom lens on my Minolta, but it's not really wide enough, or I should say it doesn't open enough. I think it's stubs. Its widest f-stop is f4. That is maximum zoom. So TLDR, I was really mad at myself, which kind of impacted my creative moment. So even the photos I ended up taking with my Fuji camera, even after the event, I was pissed at myself. And one thing I've realized this week in preparation of like kind of, I was like, okay, I need to go back to those photos and I need to make something out of them. And the thing I realized is because they were not in my way, and it sounds dumb to say it this way, but because they're not an Apple photo, they're just enough out of my way that for the 2-3 weeks in between me preparing the photos and me shooting the photos, it was enough time and enough kind of not in my memory that I was able to step back and see, oh, you know what? even if this event didn't start really well, there was a dumb mistake that I did, aka not preparing a backup role in case of that event. And one thing, I add black and white film that I could, because I can develop now, push process and things like that. But again, I cannot scan myself, and I know I had a deadline at the end of the month. So all of this is to say, one aspect I didn't realize when I was saying use two apps was that if image needs to, I need to sleep on them, they are away enough of my normal digital life that I can literally sleep on them and never see them unless I end up in Lightroom for a specific reason. And usually I end up in Lightroom because I want to do photo management. Not just because, oh, I took a photo to text to Tony or to send to Yannick. No, like I don't end up with those accidental occurrences. And that was one of the side effects that is liberating and kind of removing this thread. And also it flashed in the past few days saying, oh, wow, I was not expecting that to happen and have those benefits. So it's a bit sad that it requires to use two software, mainly because Apple Photo Library is a library-based or catalog-based software. If it was just file on my file system, that would be easy to ignore them because I can just put them in a folder and say, okay, I come back to them in a week. But that's life.
Yeah, it's interesting that you really appreciate like this distinction between like a staging area, or to some degree, like it's even more like a real dark room, right? It's like it's a dedicated space for works in progress, and then you have the cutoff where you have really like the developed photos, which are your main photo library, and you don't have to worry about bad decisions haunting you in the photo widget.
Exactly that, and exactly it's not tied to my personal life, even if photography is a hobby, not a profession, but I keep it separate. And one thing though is, while this is a benefit of using a different software, I kind of realized too that to remind myself, okay, I am in this album, I've done these photo, and then I need to do the remainder of the album. Or what's the state? Like, where am I in my process in this album? Lightroom CC is not so great. Yes, it has star system. Yes, it has rejected, I forgot what it means. Accepted, rejected, and then unflagged. They use flag for these. But one thing that I've seen people when they use Lightroom Classic, there's also using the, I don't want to say tags, but the color tags, I should call them. Because I think in the end, they just end up as keywords. But don't quote me on that. But the color tags. And one thing, if I understood correctly, some of the training materials I've read and watched, is that in Lightroom Classic, you can also put those tags on an album. So you say, okay, this album is yellow. So I know, oh, okay, it's work in progress. Because since this does not exist in Lightroom CC, I had to build one of like a system like that based on emoji, sadly. I changed the name of the album. Usually, like if an album has nothing, it means but the issue with it is like there's something I need to do with it. Usually when it's the white check mark in a green box, it's mean it's done and I've exported the photo to Apple Photo. If we take the example of the studio shoot, now I kind of blank on the emoji, but I have a different emoji. If I recall correctly, it's the white X in a green box is to say I'm done with this, but I haven't exported those photos to Apple Photo. So again, I agree with you. I can build a system with emoji, but it does feel like an act to me because, again, I end up with name with emojis in them, which it's easy to sort through visually, but it doesn't feel native to the program is what I was trying to say. So that perfect. Good. In the end, though, that's kind of like where I ended up with for digital bodies. Yes, I went a big tangent about and a big charade about like those emotional, but I think this process in the past few months is showing that it works well for digital bodies. And you'll say, but if you say it works well with digital bodies, are you implying that it doesn't work well with your scans that you receive from film? And I would say yes and no. So for editing, yes. For album things, like a lot of it is pretty similar. But there is a couple of key elements that do not vibe with me or work well with me and some of my specialness, I guess we can call it this way. And this will bring me to a quick tangent on GPS coordinates.
Oh.
So a long, long time ago, I was shooting with an iPhone and my Nikon D5000. And you know what? I was like, at that point, I think the best example I can give you was my trip in 2017 to Costa Rica, which I have, in that trip, I have a good mix of cell phone pictures and a lot of Nikon pictures. I knew since I, or quickly after I bought the Nikon D5000, I knew, A, it's important to keep your clock up to date on that camera if mm-hmm. you want to have a good library or at least a good organization so that the metadata is properly attached. Then I discovered that Nikon has a GPS module that I could attach to it. And again, 10, 15 years ago when I bought this body and I was still in college, I was low on budget, low on money. So I never end up buying it because it was, I think when it was new and sold, I think the GPS modules for it was like $200 or $300. It was pretty expensive as just a small accessory that would drain your battery faster.
And it doesn't even sound that bad for the time, honestly.
Yeah, but maybe it's sometimes I'm cheap on things. That I think that's the best way to say it. It's on certain things I don't mind spending, and it's on sundered other things that might be related to tech or photography. I'm like, it's expensive, mm-hmm. but then, and I justify it, but that I digress. But I never ended up buying it. So throughout the years, I tried to figure out, could there be a way that I can it somehow tag my photos with GPX coordinate? Because I love, as somebody that grew up since the inception of the iPhone, having a GPS and a camera and having all of that in Apple Photo Library, the map view is a gimmick, yes, but I love it.
Same here.
So judge me all you want, and I know Yannick won't, but judge me all you want. I love the map view. And you know what? I look at my photos from 2007 when I went to Egypt, and even now at nearly, I guess I'll kind of jinx it, and I kind of dox myself a bit, at nearly 32, I realized that going there when I was 16, 17, I was not mature enough. I remember being enjoyed by the view and things like that, but when I try to remember the trip, it's all a blurry mess. I mm-hmm. see the photos, I cannot tell you what this temple is about or what the statue is about. Like I forgot everything about that. And sometimes I remember, I was like, yeah, you know what, like if one day I decide to go back, yes, of course I can do the web search, but I would really have enjoyed if I was like, oh yeah, this photos, I was there in 2007, and then poof, GPS coordinate. It doesn't need to be fully precise, but just precise enough to know which temple it is. And knowing me, just having the name, I'm sure it would remind me. So again, I can do the search and things like that, but it is just an example to illustrate how I love using the map view in Apple Photo.
It's really weird because map view actually influences how I plan my trips usually, because every time I come back from a Japan trip, I have more territory on the Japan map that's covered. So I'm like, oh, now I need to go more into that direction to spread it out more.
Yeah, but it's cool. It makes sense, especially on the way you travel to Japan. Because, like, again, I know it's been a while, but you would go every year.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, it's a reminder for you to say, you know what? I shouldn't stay in the same neighborhood that I stay when I go to the clubs or I go to the arcades. Like, it's also, you should, it's a good motivation to make sure that you always visit a new part of Japan every time you go. No,
well,
I like that.
I always stay in the same place anyway because I'm stubborn like that.
Because you're you.
Yes, but I still spread out and try to visit new places every time and so that I grow my territory on the map. And the goal is to eventually cover all of it.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's an amazing goal. But yes. So, the reason I bring this up is, and I guess I wrote in my notes, being anal with GPS coordinate is because in 2017, when we came back, I was like, I want all my photos to have GPS coordinate. So let's get started. And I Google, I was like, okay, how can I get the GPS coordinate out of an iPhone photo so then I can use it in the search box? Because, oh. Let's not talk too much, but boy, oh boy, the info box in Apple Photos for years has been a huge mess, including the GPS coordinate one. And I say GPS coordinate because it always does a geolocation. Is it a reverse
geocoding? Yeah.
Yes, because I forget in which order you say reverse or not for this, but it transformed the GPS coordinate into a name, so a city name, a location name, and when you open your photos from your iPhone, it doesn't show you the coordinate, it shows you like Montreal if it was a photo taken here where I live, which is nice when you're on the map view, when you want to take the coordinate and say I know those photos are close enough to that, I want to use that coordinate. Apple Photos in its UI doesn't allow you to do that, so that's when I had to... I didn't write it. But when I do that, and I has done it... Yes, I have done it in the last year. That's the only time when I'm on the Mac, I use AppleScript. I never use AppleScript on the Mac except for this. So I found somewhere on the web, somebody as anal as me, that wrote an AppleScript that where you select a photo and then you go run the script, it talks to the Photos app via AppleScript and then gives you the coordinate. So then I can copy the coordinate, select all my digital photos from a digital body that has no GPS. And then, again, at least this part, I selected them all, open Command-I to open the command window, the info window, and then in the location, you put in the coordinate, and then voila, you've have tagged your photos from a digital body using an iPhone coordinate. That's fun!
It's also weird because I remember that in Aperture, there were similar pain-in-the-ass moments with geotagging your photos. Where I remember that, like, you couldn't just copy and paste the coordinates. It wouldn't work.
Right.
You had to, like, type the first letters of the same location that was in the previous photo, and it would show up, like, in your recent geocoding results, and you could click it, and you would get the same thing. But it's like, why can't I just use the coordinates?
Yes. I know we're already in a tangent, and I'm about to start another tangent, but this one is short. This week, I was like... I need an old Mac to run Aperture just for the sake of playing with Aperture. So I don't know when it will happen, but I was thinking about how the hell do I run Aperture nowadays?
Yeah, so that's not going to be easy.
No, and also since I never officially purchased it, I think. Yeah, I think I found a box being dropped somehow at my front door, and DMG for Aperture, I can install it. I don't think it's in the limited moment where it was available on Mac App Store. So in theory, if I had a computer that was still capable to running an OS that can run it, I cannot do that. So yeah, I nearly went on eBay saying, can I get the CD or a DVD copy of Aperture?
Let's go.
Yes, but I stopped myself before doing that. But it's still in the back of my mind that with a lot of the photo management discussion I'm having and issues I'm having, not that I would like to use it like officially, but I just want to put a couple of photos in it and then play with it. And again, since I have old bodies like the Nikon D5000 and the Fuji 100S, I think they would be old enough that RAW files would still work for them.
I don't know about the Fuji, but yeah, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Because again, Fuji is 2012, if I recall correctly, but the D5000 is 2010, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So old enough for aperture. So again, closing tangent number two, but to close tangent number one, all of all is to say, I like to be anal about the metadata on my photos. So how does that relate to film photography or scans? So when I receive scans, I ask for TIFFs. I could receive JPEGs if I want. But again, to do a bit of post-processing, especially white balance, I've seen that. I ask for TIFFs and I pay for TIFFs. So I don't really know. I didn't really try that. But again, from my experience with digital cameras, when you want to play with white balance, you can do a lot with JPEG, but again, if you get an image like a TIFF or for sure raw images, you get more latitude. And I'm being told, and I guess maybe that's why, and I should try JPEG at some point, but I'm being told that TIFF are kind of the equivalent for scanning for this. Even if they're not really raw files, they retain enough information for this. And I guess it shows in the file size, because a roll of about 36 exposure is about a gig of data. And those photos are literally 9 megapixel. So they're about 30 to 40 meg each. So it's a lot of information just for 9 megapixel images. But as you can imagine, none of the metadata exists on those scans, because guess what? They're just scans from a roll of film. So for sure, the creation date of the file and all of the EXIF data regarding creation dates are around the scanning time, not when the exposure happened. Same thing with all of the lens information, the aperture, anything about the exposure triangle metadata, none of that exists. And I never really, I realize now in preparation for this episode that I never shot film not being able to track this information. I've seen a lot of videos where people would literally write down on paper, they have special, and again, I say special, but like they have small notebooks where it's optimized for this. So again, it will say like 1 to 36 or 1 to 24, and you could take notes. And I assume that's how a lot of people have done it for the last 100 years. Like say, okay, this shot, I shot it here and I did f3.5 at 1/125th of a second, for example, or here I exposed for the shadows or exposed for the highlights and take notes for this. And around the time I started to do film photography last summer is when I've encountered an app called Emulsion, or Emulsion, but the name is in French, and it's from a developer. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's, my understanding is somebody that loves film photography and started to build this app, and that's an app literally for this. It does a couple of important features. It stores which cameras you have. It also stores the lens information, which the app is mainly optimized for prime lenses, because it's hard to, if you have a zoom lens, there's no way to say, oh, this one I told it at 50 millimeters, or mm-hmm. this one I told it at 70, or things like that. But there's a notes field, so you can do that manually. But the gist of it is you enter your camera, you enter your lenses, and it has a catalog of the well-known films available currently. So you can select your stock, and then you have the recording screen is more or less like a shutter. It's a shutter, a record button, and then two wheels, one for speed and one for aperture. And you can do that and record this information, which is amazing, because then you can do something with that information, which goes back to me being anal about metadata. I can put that back to the scans, so I can correct the time, which is amazing. I think ignoring a lot of the exposure triangle metadata, that would be something I would utterly despise. And I've seen friends that have pollution again in their photo library because they've imported images either that they scanned from films, or it was old, like 2002 digital bodies, and something happened, but the JPEGs they have stored somehow, they don't have any metadata. Mm-hmm. So when they have done this in like one day in 2012, 10 years after, like they have 1,000 photos, 2,000 photos in the same day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like that's a real pain in the ass.
Yes. And I don't know how they live with the library, but they do. So, so in the end, I end up at the end with a CSV export that I can open in Numbers, and it creates a nice table. And then I can start tagging my photos. But that's the problem, is I am back into I need to take care of the file themselves before I import them into Lightroom. Or find a system where I can change this metadata in Lightroom. So that's how I started. At first, I was importing them. The process is as follows. So I received the scans as TIFFs from the lab via WeTransfer. Because it's a roll of film, all the portrait shots are in landscape. So I would usually quickly open preview, look at the photos, kind of be in awe of my photos. I love this feeling of you receive your scans and you look at the photos and like, oh yeah, I remember when I did this. I remember that, like this long feedback loop as downsides. But the feeling of seeing your photo for the first time is a major plus, in my opinion. So we usually do this quick process in preview. Also do the Command R and I think it's Command R to do the rotation. But I would do the basic rotation. So at least when you exit photos, it will bake them back in the TIFF correctly. So that's amazing. And then I would import them into Lightroom. I'm still using keywords. So I would use a lot of keywords to tag, okay, these photos were taken with my Minolta X700. These photos were shot with Kodak Gold. So also document the stock use for comparison and for the like with the episode I did last January. It was super fun to pick photos to show to you all based on the stocks I wanted to describe because they're all tagged correctly for this. But let's talk a bit more about, and again, last but not least, creation date. I think nowadays, even Apple Photos allows you, and I think it's not new at all. Oh no, it is new on iPad. Even on recent version of iPad OS and Apple Photo, you can change the time on a photo, which is amazing. So Lightroom CC also has that. Recently, I was like, okay, you know what? My system with tags, with keywords, works well. But I'm abusing of the keyword system for field that already exists in the EXIF standard. I think it's called standard, but more or less in the metadata. I could put the exposure time. I can put the aperture. I could put the GPS coordinate and things like that. So what would it take to do that? And that's where I started to lose patience. This is interesting because it seems that a lot of the modern, and I've even installed like a tried demo version of other software. Shout out, but I'm not sure I should mention it because its UI is atrocious. But one product that is optimized to do what I think the word is called culling. People use it photographers use it. It's just to go through your photos. This is called Photo Mechanic, and this is optimized for culling your photos. So going through, deciding which one you want to document to use. Also, it's more file system based. So you just open one of your folder in the software, and then it shows your photo. You can start modifying some metadata, but it seems that, as with everything in tech, EXIF means one thing, and I think the other one is IPTC.
Yeah.
I forgot to put notes of the letters, but there is a part of the EXIF data that is more about a lot of that metadata. Okay, where did you? No, I didn't say where because the GPS coordinate are part of EXIF, but IPTC will contain, oh, this was a studio shoot. This was this model, and you want to put the model's name. So it was, I guess, invented for professional, and a lot of software allows you to modify this while you import. But my goal is to modify tags that usually a digital camera would generate. And right now, luckily for me, the scan that the lab uses doesn't create their own EXIF data, nor puts their own name saying that that is an image scan from this scanner. I've seen people when they upload the photos on different social networks that that's what happens sometimes depending on the scanner they use. Like, you end up with the metadata of the scanner, which, guess what? We don't care about. And that's where the photo management part of my film scans are on the border of saying pisses me off. Because I really like this data, but I'm really, really mad that I cannot use EXIF for its purpose. And I don't... Even to this day, I don't understand why photo management software, like Lightroom, Lightroom is both, it's photo editing and photo management, doesn't allow you to change this information. One, I was exploring other software, I mentioned Photo Mechanic, they only focus on IPTC tags. I looked at the big competition to Lightroom, which is Capture One, and there's an entry where it's like, can I modify EXIF data in Capture One? No, sorry, this is not a feature we support. I'm like, but why? But I guess the but why is because nobody does that. They just allow the manufacturer, it's the manufacturer's job to do that. I'm like, it makes sense, but I kind of wish you could do that. And I'll stop you already. I already hear your concerns. But Luco, there is an EXIF library to code programs for it. Yes, in Perl or a CLI tool, but all the GUIs I found there are either dead apps or on Windows. And please, we're not introducing Windows in my photo workflow. No. Or they are kind of shitty apps. I've tried one at work, and I'm like, okay, I tried a demo, and they want me to pay but the UX is not so great. And I kind of wonder if it's because the EXIF date spec is not so great, because there's a lot of different fields that are for the same thing. And should I fill all of them to contain the same data to make sure that all the software that reads it is okay? Or is it because they started with that field and then they modernized to this new field in the spec? All of this is to say it's really, really, it seems to be a hard problem, because there doesn't seem to have a lot of good software built around it. And I guess, Yannick, you might say, I want to build one. I'm kind of tempted to build one, but...
Well, the first thing I would say is that libexif, which is the big library for this, it's a C library. It's not a Perl library. So you have no excuse to not use that if you develop something yourself. Not that you have no excuse not to write your own. You have plenty of excuses not to write your own. But but at least like it's something that's compatible with the whole Apple development suite, so you don't have to worry about integrating with Perl and shit, because that would be a pain in the ass.
Right. So I've started to also look at the main way to process. So let's say you don't want to have Lightroom read the data for you, or Preview read the data for you. You want to read the data yourself. There is a EXIF CLI tool that has been pretty common and supported for years. And it seems that this one would do what I need. I could even in theory, from my limited reading of the documentation, but that's when I click X on the documentation, because I could possibly even take the CSV I receive from the iOS app that does the tracking, and then use it as a basis to say, okay, this column is this tag, this other column is that tag.
Yeah, and I was going to ask what? You if you had some exportable format for that.
I end up with CSVs.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like, for a lot of nerds maybe listening to my voice currently, they're like, oh yes, there's a CLI tool. Just have fun with it. I'm like, oh no, that sounds like work again. Oh, oh.
You disappoint me.
I know. I know. I'm not surprised you're saying this. But yeah, that's kind of where I ended up with, which is kind of like, okay, I think I'll just abuse of keywords still.
Oh my God.
But I'm disappointed in myself that I'm abusing of keywords because I know EXIF does it. But the funny part too is I've seen there are a couple of iOS apps. I think one thing I've done recently is the Glass social network I've been mentioning. They're pretty strong, a bit like what Flickr used to do. I know they still do it, but nobody uses Flickr anymore. So
it's sad, but true.
Yeah. But one of their questions in the FAQ is, hey, especially now that you can search per bodies and lenses and things like that, they're like, hey, what can I do to add EXIF data to my photos? Because you're heavily processing it and like using it for certain features. And they have a lot of suggested apps. And most of them, it's either like, okay, I've seen one on iOS, but it's based on the photo library, which we discussed. I don't want it to be based on the photo library. Some of them are for Windows. And, oh, yeah, the other one is use Lightroom Classic. I'm like, oh, crap. Oh, crap. Yeah.
You know, this reminds me a lot of note-taking apps and to-do apps and all of that stuff, which is like, it seems like the most simple problem space imaginable, except everybody uses them in weird ass ways that is incompatible with everybody else's workflow. And then there's absolutely nothing that fits your particular use case. And that's how you end up with 3 billion different to-do list apps and whatever that for every imaginable type of workflow. And even then, there's not one for everybody. And I think like photo management and especially like niche metadata tools like that, you're never going to be happy unless you write your own. I hate to say it, but it's
possibly
true.
Possibly. I'm kind of coming to that realization. And the other one is, I think the introduction, the popularity of catalog-based application where they own photo management and photo editing in the same application, I think also is killing or not helping the photo management market. I know in the past I've made comments that your dad utterly despised, which it was like, I kind of want Adobe Bridge for my photos, which is one of the way I describe my sandbox, photo sandbox. And I remember having feedback from your dad that's like, you will regret saying this the day you use, or I know it's dead now, but if you would have used Adobe Bridge in the past.
Which is weird because he was a big user. I guess he would know then.
Yeah, he was a big user, but he says kind of like, in my recollection is he was a big user. He's like, you kind of are right, but not at the same time. And B, it's an Adobe product. Nobody likes it, but we were forced to use it. Or kind of something like that is my recollection. Guess what? We might have a follow-up about this.
Probably.
Since I might have misquoted him. So if that happens, I'm already saying I'm sorry in advance. But what I was trying to say is because of the catalog-based application, I think it kind of killed the need because they become one silo, or not kill the need, but kill the market. Is they become the silo. Put your photo, we'll do everything for you, but we will ignore EXIF, or we'll just be read-only for that data because who cares about modifying it? I'm like, but it's part of digital photo management. It's super important, I think. And again, I ended up with this problem because of my film scan. And that's why I split it from my points about digital bodies to the film section, is because I ended up with this problem even more with having scanned and being anal about my photo metadata, I guess you could say.
But like, let's be real. Like, all you really need... I'm going to simplify your problem and solve all your problems. All you really need is a basic app to run between getting the files from the lab sent to you and importing them into Lightroom that takes that CSV and sets the tags.
Correct. And I would even push my luck to say it runs all the tags, including creation date and GPS coordinates.
Yeah. And like that would be ideal, and then you could just put those new files into Lightroom and you don't really have to think about it. It's just one more step along the pipeline. I don't think that's unreasonable. I think you could probably, I know you don't want to, but I know you could probably automate that really easily right now with CLI tools. And it could be, it could be a nice stopgap, and then you can make a GUI for it later and everyone will be happy.
Right. The problem with my own proclivities, I guess I should say, is that I was just like, okay, yeah, but isn't it the, if I create something as a CLI workflow right now, am I again just bitching because then I'll be like, oh, I need to sit down on my Mac and I love to do that on the iPad. So I'm like, oh, but then I should write an iPad app. And I'm like, okay, no. Closing tab again, like closing the EXIF documentation, the EXIF CLI documentation. I'm like, okay, no.
You can build LibEXIF for iPad. It's not... I mean, there are options to all of these things. It just sounds like you don't want another project, which is perfectly fine. I respect that. But it's not like it's a giant project either.
Possibly. And you know what? Maybe that's part of the... I didn't say there was no therapy in this episode in the end about my photo workflow, but it might, and that might be the section. You might be correct. Is that it's more I dread it because I don't want another project versus I'm already having a lot of projects with photo in general. So there's that. But yeah, no... we shall see what happens. This app, I'll put a link in the show notes, the Emulsion. I really like it. It's pretty simple. It kind of describes what you're saying. It's pretty simple. There's not that much fluff around it. It's pretty neat. A couple of bugs, but again, I'm sure they're going to get fixed at some point. But it's a pretty well-defined project, and I would be sure I could do the same thing with EXIF data for this. So, yes. If we go back to the fact that I'm using keywords a lot, I'm happy that Lightroom CC offers keyword on all platform. The fact that they don't offer the functionality in all platform the same way is frustrating, especially because on iOS and iPadOS, you cannot do select photos and then apply it to all tags, like I mentioned in the previous photo management episode. And the worst part, even if, let's say I want to go through the 36 exposures and then do it one by one, I don't know why they haven't implemented this on the iOS. Like, I think there's no reason because the sidebar looks the same as the Mac one. But when you start typing your keyword, it doesn't even show what you have in the system already. So if I start to type Minolta X700, guess what? I have to type it all on iOS. Only on the Mac, it would quickly filter or have suggestions where then you don't end up typing too much. So yes, I bitch a lot about Apple Photos having inconsistencies between platform. Adobe has the same problem. And I'm living with this as much as I can. Lastly, on this photo management for scans, one thing I agree with what you said, Yannick, about the small projects is, yes, if I build a dedicated tools to get to manage this metadata, apply them on each file, and then go into Lightroom, my workflow is 100% like the digital workflow. Like, if I'm able to do that outside of Lightroom and then move to Lightroom, then I could focus completely on the photo editing in Lightroom. And this brings me to the couple of notes I have about photo editing. I've mentioned in previous episode that I try to, or I know enough that I'm dangerous, but trying to do my best to kind of learn more and also try to find a way that I like it. But the more I realize it is I don't mind doing small tweaks, but like it's, if I can do something, if I spend 5-10 minutes on a photo, 10 minutes is a lot, right? I need to have my exposure set, my color sets correctly or close enough that I need to do a couple of tweaks. And overall, Lightroom has a lot of capabilities, but I don't use them all. But I have enough that it's good for me, I guess. It's fit. And slowly but surely, what I realize is every time, like, oh, I encounter a small problem, but I feel that because I have my sandbox, like I feel a bit more adventurous. Well, maybe take the time to go watch a YouTube video and say, how can I do this? How can I do that? And that's something I realized that previously, because I was afraid to fuck things up in my library, I would maybe stay on the paths I know for photo editing because I would know how to undo them and know how those would be safe edit for me. So I wouldn't only do those. So I'm slowly exploring. But again, if there's one thing after 18 months of being back in photo a lot, and photography a lot, is I realize that I love a lot of the processes to take photos and things like that, but the post-processing is not the thing I enjoy about a lot of that. And I think it's fine. Like a lot of people, I'll give you an example. When I was at the Zoom session this week about the blacksmithing contest, somebody said, I spent 8 hours having fun, trying things, and then just playing with this photo. And then everybody's like, you spent 8 hours? And I'm like, you know what? You do you. If that's what you like about photo is doing photo editing, go spend 8 hours. But I am not that type of person. And I am even more, not confident, but more kind of like, I know that I'm not that type of photographer. I like to be out there, take photos, things like that. So I don't mind like scrapping photos, especially with digital bodies. Also, I'm starting to change a bit of my bits on how I shoot digital, saying like, okay, try to slow down, try to in body have a proper exposure, proper framing. And also same thing with, again, that comes with film because of the price and everything and the limited number of exposure. So I try to transform this so that in the end, I end up with possibly less photos, or in digital, if I'm not with a ton of photos, I feel more confident to say like, here's the 5 I like, who cares about the 60 others I took? Because they're just digital file. Maybe I needed to take 60 to get to those 3 nice photos, and that's fine. So, and now that they're in the sandbox, they can stay there and not be an annoyance. Okay, perfect. So yeah, for photo editing, that's the small touches. So again, Lightroom is quite powerful, but I have a neutral opinion about the photo editing tools in Lightroom. I think one thing that Adobe is doing right, while also being what the hell moment. Remember when we had our tangent multiple episodes ago about why does Adobe have Lightroom and Lightroom CC? Two products that does the exact same thing. Not exactly, but bear with me. One thing I've realized part of attending this studio session course when we did post-processing is that teacher was like, oh, you need Lightroom Classic. I'm like, can I come with just Lightroom? And she was like, I guess. And I discovered that the editing UI from Classic to Lightroom to, I think in Photoshop it's called Camera Raw, which is the dedicated UI, it's more or less the same UI with more or less the same functionality. Maybe the naming is a bit off or the button is not at the right location, but I think this is something that in the past decade, Adobe has changed a lot to ensure that the editing tool are consistent on all their editing tools. So if you're a Photoshop person, you learn photography, say my photos needs to end up in Photoshop somehow where I do my edits, you'll end up in the similar yard that if you're a Lightroom Cloud person, if you grew up with that, if you've grown into photography in that world, or in between, if you've been doing digital photography in the last 20 years, but you've never been a Photoshop person, if you're a Lightroom Classic, this photo editing section, you end up with that. Again, Lightroom doesn't offer layering, so it's more like changing colors, tweaking the colors, masking and things like that. But layering, for sure, you might end up to There's still a little bit, but there you might have to end up in Photoshop at some point. But the idea is when you end up in this camera raw mode that Photoshop calls it, like this camera mode is literally in all the Adobe software. So that I think was kind of a good plus. But at the same time, if you put your product manager at and think about it 3 seconds, like why do you have the same UI in three different applications that are supposedly there to do the exact same thing?
Well, but, I think I know how they did it, but it's kind really? Of... Really? Right. Well, I don't know if this is still the case, but at least at some point, all of that kind of UI stuff was written in Lua, so they could easily port it from one project to another because it was just scripting around like the same engine.
Hmm. Oh, I remember that Adobe was a big user of Lua, but I forgot why. But now that you start to explain it, it kind of rings a bell.
Yeah, Lightroom, the original Lightroom, I don't know about subsequent version, was entirely done in Lua, which is why it didn't really feel native at all on the Mac. But yeah, they've been big Lua users, and I think eventually like a lot of that stuff wound up in Lua code that was being shared across many of their projects.
That would make sense. That would definitely make sense. Okay, that wraps it up for photo editing. I have a prepare the way segment in this episode.
Oh, God. Are you preparing the way for medium format or what? Oh, no. I don't like that silence.
Not now.
Okay.
Let's rewind a bit. I mentioned I started to develop, but I don't have any scanning equipment.
Right.
So at some point, I want to get some scanning equipment. Some is coming, but later this summer. Other discussion. But for the sake of this discussion, I'm starting to look at what it entails to do camera-based scanning. So nowadays, there's kind of two worlds, and I will go quickly about this. There's either flat... three worlds. You ask your lab to scan, and they have what they call like roll scanners, or like it just goes through your roll fast. I forgot the exact name they use for those scanner, but something like roll or rolling scanner or something like that. There's the flatbed, but dedicated flatbed for film, and more popular these days is using your digital camera to scan your negative. And the main reason, I think the main, those for sure there's the lab, but the two other camps about flatbed versus digital camera, I think it comes from quickly saying like, okay, there's still flatbed produced today to do scanning film, but they're more or less based on early 2000 technology. They haven't really evolved. Whereas digital cameras, their sensors has evolved greatly, and you could get way more resolution out of those versus a new scanner that is based on early 2000 technology. But whether one or the other, process is somewhat similar. I think with flatbed, you might be able to end up with a positive image. So let's not forget, when you end up with your strip of film, in most cases, unless you're shooting slide, you end up with a negative of your image. So the colors are all fucked up. So you need to invert the colors to end up with a positive. And the reason I say I need to prepare myself or prepare the way for this is because in theory, I'll end up with twice the files. Because if I end up scanning, which I'm going through out of camera scanning, just to be clear. Maybe with scanner, the software where you scan can do the conversion internally. But you more or less end up with double the files because you would end up with your raw from a camera that you pass in specific software. And then you end up with a positive. But there are a couple of popular options. One that is a dedicated app for it. But the other one that is pretty popular in the film community is a Lightroom Classic plugin.
Of course.
Are you really surprised that no. I was about to mention Lightroom Classic? So let's go back a bit and mention all of the things about possibly using Lightroom Classic to fix my EXIF data problem. So I haven't done that yet, but it is in the back of my mind to explore possibly going to Lightroom Classic. And in the sound of my voice, you can already hear that I'm even myself dreading this moment, but that might have to happen. So all of this is to say it hasn't happened yet, but for sure it is one of the explore I might have to do. And I kind of wish, thinking about it though, is I kind of wish that Lightroom Classic was not catalog based, because I could have just seen like, okay, Lightroom Classic becomes my app to just do film conversion. Right? I put the negative, I run the plugin, they give me a new DNG. I think I will convert my RAW from the camera to a DNG, if I want to keep a RAW image. But still, then I could put it back in Lightroom or just kind of have it more of as kind of a silo to treat my negative, make them positive, and then end up into the normal flow. But again, Lightroom is Lightroom, catalog base, and we shall see what happened. But again, this preparing the way was a good segue to the future, and there's many two things. It's like preparing the way from film negative, three things, excuse me, preparing the way. I haven't thrown out, and I guess I've kind of described my ideal film scanning app right now, but I haven't thrown out the idea of making it a real development side project of building either flows and application. And again, I was kind of looking at something that we could also do on the iPad, so that could be pretty fun too. But not sure if I'll go through with this. And in the past few weeks, I've heard the call of the siren that is Capture One.
Oh, dear.
I'll just say it this way. One of the things that really I need to research it more is that I think Capture One is currently, and that's a perception, doing a better job at being multi-platform, Mac and iPad, than what Lightroom CC does.
I didn't even realize it was on iPad.
It is on iPad since last year, and not rumors, but they are teasing it today that this summer it's going to be on the phone.
Hmm.
And that is pretty interesting. Again, my understanding is they kind of offer cloud storage, but it's not cloud storage. It's more kind of like, oh, we share the same file, so that me, the director of photo from this shoot, plus the photographer, exchange images. Like, it seems to me like a really, really professional, optimized for professionals and kind of like creative work, and not just to have photos in the cloud. So, yeah. The other benefit of using Capture One is since I'm half Nikon, half Fuji, Capture One has been pretty known to have better RAW processing of Xtran sensor RAW images than Lightroom. Yes, it works, but in theory, not in theory, there are a couple of differences of how the RAW engine in Lightroom processes Xtran sensor data versus Capture One. Capture One seems a bit better on that front. Again, do I care? A little bit. It seems too that Capture One might be a bit faster to update to the new camera. Again, I don't have a new camera from Fuji, but it seems that they're kind of the perception I have, again, perception, still doing research on that, is that they're kind of more into the Fuji community or more into the Fuji bandwagon than Adobe would be more optimized to Nikon, Canon, and for sure Sony cameras. Again, all of those friends work on Capture One. I have an hesitation because I was watching tutorial where you need to enable certain feature for certain cameras, and I kind of forget if I saw Canon in that list of cameras. So
I don't think you're legally allowed to ship a photography app that doesn't work with Canon cameras.
That's what I would assume too, but I guess I'm just misremembering things versus them not supporting Canon cameras, because I think they would get slaughtered on the market.
Yeah.
But who knows? Hey, they still support their Phase 1 cameras, which is the same company making Capture One, right? So, and I guess they're the main ones supporting those. So, yeah. So, to conclude the call of Capture One, it seems that it's a different mindset. And you know what? I watch a lot of tutorial, and I would really invite you to look at recent screenshot of Capture One, because even if it's a cross-platform application, works on Windows, the way the UI is on macOS, it has kind of macOS feeling still. It's a bit weird. Like sometimes like the toolbar and things like that, like, but I don't know. I have a better macOS vibe. Again, not having used this app, but seeing people teach me how to use this app and then just playing in the UI, then what you see with Lightroom.
Yeah, it's closer to Cocoa conventions for sure.
Right. That's a better way than I just, a better way to describe it than I just did compared to Cocoa. But again, and one other benefit I think Capture One would be is, it would possibly, not such a benefit, I'm still thinking about it, but it is one of the software that allows you to be session-based, where you put your file in the file system, you put your project file next to it, and then it knows where to read on the file system, whereas the file, the library file, doesn't need to contain all the photos. So that's interesting. This is kind of, I think... it's not the first time I mentioned this. I mentioned it in the recent episode about desktop app, desktop class app on iPad. It is kind of a workflow that is growing on me. So, but it has its benefits and downsides. One of the downsides is backup and syncing between devices and things that we used to do years ago, and kind of something that I don't want to go back to possibly. So we shall see. And that's it for my photography editing and management updates. I expect to have future episodes about certain topics I've discussed, but I am in a state ignoring EXIF data management that I pretty enjoy. And I hope that I figure out a solution short to medium term to this. But again, I don't envision big changes to the workflow as described today in this episode. I think the main big takeaway you can set is, now that I've lived through it for a few months, a few months now, I'm kind of getting in the vibe and I'm getting the benefit out of it. Yes, there's a couple of downsides, but I feel that I am happy. Remember, I was pretty hesitant to move to that type of workflow where I have two apps. I might regret the choice of the app, but... In general, I think it was a good decision to my mental model of how I like to work for this. Even today, I would not explain. I still struggle to explain why I am so precious about the photo library. And I think it's just because it's the digital asset I care the most about in my life. So that would be the way to put it is, my computer could burn today. I don't fucking care about like my receipts and things like that, but this, or my like iMessage history, but this, if it disappears, oh boy. So I think that's where it comes from. So having a sandbox is keeping me at ease for this.
I'm just going to suggest that the next episode you do about photography should probably be about photo backup, because it sounds like you need it.
I guess I'm not the best example to follow, because all my photo library is on iCloud and that's my backup. But that's another problem I need to figure out now. In my defense, up until I used to be a Drobo user, it was backed up on the Drobo and in Amazon. But since my library is now on... Yes, now it's on the iMac that has enough storage space to store it on disk. It's on the internal SSD, and I have an SSD big enough. So in the past, that was my main limitation, which had the benefit of, if it's already on an external storage, it was then, I guess, easier to back up. Because for historical reasons that I don't want to go to today, a lot of the things I wanted to back up were already on the Drobo. So it was easier to just say, back up what's on the Drobo and ignore the iMac. So if the iMac burns down, that's okay. Mm-hmm. I don't care because everything's backed up. So yeah, so I have to see. But again, I need to look at backup software. And remember when I was saying I don't want to build an EXIF app? I don't want to shop for backup software. So
yeah, I know that. That sucks too.
Yes. So that's it for me.
Alrighty then. You can find the show notes to this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/207, or you can find all of our back catalog at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is still on the Fediverse. We haven't been defederated from the rest of the world yet.
That's good news.
The show is at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. You can also find us individually on the Fediverse. I am at Socarina at icosahedron.website, and you can find Luca Olivier at
luco@mastodon.social.
Cool, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.